Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for staying up late with us tonight and every weekday night. Well, with me just on Saturday mornings, quite honestly. But thank you for anybody who listens at any time here to the great WGN radio. Joining us on the phone right now is a man who maybe caught the waves of WGN and some Cub games in his youth just outside of Dubuque, Iowa. Terry McDermott is the author of Off Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception. He joins us on the phone right now. Hey, Terry, how are you this morning?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good.
It's not morning here. It's not morning. It's late. It's late at night here.
It's morning wherever you are, Terry. Come on. It's late. I appreciate you staying up and hanging out with us. And I've really enjoyed your book. It just came in the mail today, so I've gotten close to halfway through it. But I just love the way that you sort of I've been describing it to friends as a love and hate letter to baseball all at the same time. Because baseball is... Go ahead.
Much more love than hate.
Yes, of course. But, you know, as a fan of the Mariners and as you know, us fans here of the Cubs, baseball can be a very frustrating experience, even if you don't play the game but and are just a fan of it.
Yeah, you know, being a sports fan is kind of a weird thing, isn't it, in a way? And being a fan of a generally kind of a crappy team is, you know, there's no rational explanation why anybody would do that to themselves. You kind of just end up there somehow, you know, it's like you're a piece of driftwood and that's where you came ashore.
I think eventually when you get beaten down so bad, it becomes a bit of a badge of honor, doesn't it? That you start to wear proudly like, that's right, I am a Cleveland Browns fan and someday we're going to do it all and I will be there because I'm not going to walk away from this.
No.
Well, I can say that. I can say it, Terry, because you know what happened here in Chicago last year. So, my 44 years of ineptitude paid off.
Yeah, well, there's no honor in it, as far as I can tell. But you know, winning must be fun. I don't know. I've heard tell that it's a lot of fun.
Well, and I think it's, I understand you're saying there's no honor in it because you haven't gotten there yet. But when you do, you think it was all worth it. It's like living in Chicago, I always say. We suffer through the winter. It sucks. It's awful. And we all say, what the hell are we doing here? But then when spring hits, you think, this is why. Because all that suffering made this moment that much more sweeter. When the weather comes back and everybody's wearing less clothes and they're eating it, you know, out on Michigan Avenue, it's just, it becomes this awesome time of year. But it wouldn't be as nice if it was San Diego year-round, right?
Well, no. I mean, then look, if you're in Chicago and you're waiting for spring and then spring is over, then you got summer. And summer's even worse than the winter.
Oh, not even close. No. Maybe like in 95 when 400 people died. But otherwise, no. It's not that bad in the summer. It's still pretty nice.
You know, I moved to Southern California 20 years ago from the Northwest. I lived in Seattle and Portland for a long time. And Southern California was the enemy. I mean, like, you know, up there we were cool, we were hip, and
right.
we were progressive, and this was the land of God knows what went on down here. And I came here for a job, not because I ever wanted to be here, because it really was like going into enemy lands. And I got here, and it's like you walk out every day and you go, who knew?
How nice it could be, the weather. Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't been hiding this stuff. It never fails to satisfy. It's, other than the fact that you can't drive, you can't leave your house, you know.
Little things.
Yeah, little things. Can't breathe.
I moved to L.A. out of college, so I lived there for 2 years, and I will say that I know that now I'd probably appreciate a lot more, but at the time, I missed, like, thunderstorms and real weather and you know,
that's
in the
true.
Summer when it was 100 degrees 84 days straight, it kind of like got depressing, I thought, too.
Well, I live you know, 100 yards from the beach, so it never gets to be 100 degrees here. I mean, a hot day here is 82, you know, a cold day is 62, so it's pretty nice. But I know what you mean about real weather. I mean, I remember driving. You mentioned Dubuque. From Dubuque to my hometown of Cascade one night, it must have been 1969 or 70, and ran into a thunderstorm that was so bright. I turned my lights off and drove for 20 miles. It was thunder and lightning the whole way. I mean, scare the hell out of you. Man, That's real weather.
That is real weather. So you grew up in Cascade, Iowa. How far outside of Dubuque is that?
25 miles.
25 miles outside of Dubuque. So you probably, as a kid, you mentioned that you built your own little radio and you'd have to hang it on the highest pole in town to get the a signal. Yeah. Did you pick up some Cub games on WGN as a kid?
Absolutely. WGN and Camo X were the big stations that I could get.
Wow.
I mean, I could get local stations, but the only two places out of town I could get were those two. They were both big powerhouse stations, still are, I guess.
Yeah, you
get those. And if you're a kid, look, Cascade was 1,000 people. And, you knew everybody in town. They all knew you, which was, like, good and bad. But, getting the radio signal from Chicago was like, my God, there's life on Earth.
Now, how in the world do you become a Mariners fan? Because you grew up a Yankees fan because your dad's a Yankees fan, but you're in Iowa, you're picking up Cub games and Cardinal games. How was your life and your allegiances not set in stone by the time you got up to the Pacific Northwest?
Well, I sort of fled Cascade. It's a weird thing. When I think about it now, and whenever I've talked about it to people ever since leaving, it seems like an idyllic thing, right? It was like a Huck Finn childhood. It was magical in a lot of ways. It was completely innocent. It was wonderful. I left the first train out of town, man. And I've been trying to figure out why ever since. But I went to completely the wrong place. I joined the military, which I wasn't suited for whatsoever, and kind of lost track of baseball and family and community and sort of myself for a while, and ended up in Portland, Oregon, in the middle 1980s, and discovered Bill James, of all things. I joined a fantasy baseball league, one of the first fantasy leagues in the world, and discovered Bill James through that. Wasn't even a fan, really, but just wanted to win the fantasy league, and then fell in love with the statistics of the game. And then a couple of years later, moved to Seattle and started listening to this great play-by-play guy that the Mariners had then, Dave Niehaus. I mean, wherever I was, even when I wasn't really a fan anymore, I listened to baseball on the radio. Baseball on the radio is the best thing ever, right? I mean, it's better than sex. If you don't turn radio dials anymore, but when you did, without ever hearing anybody talk or anything else, when you hit a baseball game, you heard it, right? It's just it's like that hum, this weird thing out there in the universe somewhere. You just hear that noise, that background. It's just a great thing. And a great play-by-play guy is like a seductress. I mean, they make you fall in love.
Well, I'm going to send this tape to Pat Hughes. He's really going to love everything that you just said. I think he's going to love it. He's going to be a little freaked out by it, but he's going to love it.
No, it's the best thing about baseball to me is listening to it on the radio. I mean, I love going to games. I've been to literally hundreds of them, maybe thousands. Jesus,
yeah,
that's
crazy. I would think by now.
I came back into it, and I was actually a fan of Niehaus before I was a fan of the Mariners, because then, as now, they were a pretty bad team. They had high points in there, but
sure.
But they weren't real good then, and I realized, it really reattached me to my love of the game from being a kid, and learning the game from my dad, and I had kids of my own, three daughters, and they all learned to play, and they became fans. One of them is a White Sox fan, by the way. She lived in Chicago for 5 or 6 years and became a White Sox fan. So, It's just a great, it's a good life companion. I mean, baseball is there.
It really is.
I tell people all the time, it's like, look, people complain about it's too slow, it's too this or too that. I says, look, you take whatever you want. Baseball will allow you to take how much of it you want or how little. You go to a game, you don't have to watch every pitch. I do. You don't have to. I mean, you can have a conversation with somebody. Mm-hmm. You can have a beer. You can take a nap. I don't care. But you come back, baseball is going to be there for you. It gives what you want.
I agree completely. The MLB Network ends up on our TV every night at night. It's background. You can walk in and out of a ball game. You can't really do that with most other sports that are on TV. It kind of commands your attention or it doesn't. But baseball, you can keep coming back and forth, figure out what happened, and talk. I mean, Let's face it, it's the only sport really without a clock. So although they keep trying to put one in the game, basically. But but it is a relaxed pastime. I mean, it really is America's pastime. And it does seem to bring family together and give people a bond that I don't think anything else quite does in the same way.
I used to joke with people that intellectuals love baseball because it's the only game that's slow enough they can understand. and I think that's true to a certain extent. It's there, right? You can see it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true. You can see it. The book is called Off Speed, Baseball Pitching and the Art of Deception. We're speaking with Terry McDermott. Why did you decide to write about pitching in particular if you're going to write a somewhat love letter to baseball?
Oh, man. I'd written three other books. I've been a journalist for a long time and left newspapers and started writing books. And two of the books were on 9/11 or aspects of terrorism. And one was on brain science. These were not easy undertakings.
I would imagine not.
And
because
I'm a journalist, I don't know anything about anything. I just I have a notebook and a pen and a willingness to learn.
Yeah.
The terrorism books in particular just wore me down. I mean, I was depressed, exhausted. Mm. It's one of those. It's a very enveloping subject. Obviously it has some import in the world, but it's a hard thing to report about, and it's not a good thing to think about. I mean, I dreamed about it every night for years, 5-6 years. And at the end of the second terrorism book, I had had it. I was just dead to the world. And my agent said, well, why don't you do something fun? He's a New Yorker and is a Mets fan, and whenever we would get together, we would talk about baseball, not terrorism or neuroscience or anything like that. He says, write a baseball book. And I said, I'm a serious guy. There's a lot of baseball books out there. There's a lot of baseball writers that I know more about it than I do. I should do something important. He says, man, you're stupider than I ever thought you were. Take a break. Write the book. Have some fun. He says, well, what do you want to do? I says, I don't know. I mean, how about Alzheimer's? That'd be a good book. He says, oh, yeah. Yeah, let's have some fun now, guys. He didn't take much to persuade me that baseball would be a good thing. And the heart of baseball is the pitcher-hitter confrontation. That's the whole game.
Yeah.
And that's where it gets interesting and fun. That's where it gets tricky. So if you're going to write about it, probably a one-time thing for me. I'll probably never write about, never write another book about baseball. My next book's probably going to be on the Kardashians. So,
you're going back to serious journalism. I see. Okay.
Well, no, it's trying to explain Trump. I think there's a relationship there.
Well, that's interesting.
That deserves to be looked at. If you're going to write one baseball book, you got to write about pitching, right?
Yeah, it makes sense. And I've never seen a book written, or I've never heard of a book, if it has been, to try to explain the different pitches and why they're so important. Because really, you write about it in the book, and all we really talk about, on the MLB Network. So we watch Quick Pitch and the highlight shows every day.
Yeah.
And what do they show all day long? They show home runs, or if a dominant pitcher throws a bunch of strikeouts. And generally, it's you want to see the clock, and is he hitting 100 miles an hour? Or Aldis Chapman's hitting 105 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And it blows you away. But as you write in the book, and as people have said forever, if all you have is that fastball, it's not going to get you as far as you think. Even if you're throwing it 105 miles an hour, eventually these guys are going to time it and they're going to kill it, right?
Yeah. There's two things my two favorite things in this book, one of which I didn't even report. It just was James Shields, the right-hander, who's on a bunch of teams. It was he's been a good major league pitcher. He wrote a really nice memoir, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. I mean, Christ, how long has he been in the league? I mean, you wrote the memoir probably earlier than anybody ever. Mm. But there's a line in it. He says, like, if a major league hitter gets what he's looking for, he'll take you to the moon. You know, and it's so true, right? If you're not deceiving them, you're going to be dead eventually. And the other thing is, the guy I originally wanted to feature in the book, which it didn't work out, was one of my favorite all-time pitchers, Jamie Moyer, mm-hmm. who was, you know, the best Mariner pitcher, the winningest Mariner pitcher ever, but a guy who pitched until he was almost 50 years old. With, you know, if you watched him pitch, it was like you or I playing catch. I mean, he couldn't hardly break a window pane with his fastball. I mean, he won 20 games late in his career with the Mariners. I don't think he was topping out at like 83, 84. And he would throw back-to-back-to-back changeups. Mm. And I asked him once, I mean, aren't you, like, physically afraid of getting hurt? You know, throwing this, like, 78-mile-an-hour dinky little thing up there to these goons at the plate? He just laughed. He thought that was the funniest thing ever. He says, look, if it wasn't for the vanity of major league hitters, he said, I would never have had a career at all. And that's completely it. He says, they're always sitting there looking fastball. It doesn't matter if you've thrown them 8 changeups in a row. They're looking fastball. They just do not want to get beat. It's because, you know, they're manly, right?
Yeah.
They don't want to get beat.
They're up there to hit that ball hard.
Right, yeah. That to me is that was the whole inspiration for the book was that. You know, how can a guy just get by on nothing?
Well, and it's fascinating, Terry, because and I have to take a quick break and do the news real quick. Can you hang on and do some more with us?
Yes, absolutely.
But I want to get into, because you mentioned that, he says if it wasn't for the vanity of these hitters, but if it wasn't for the vanity of the pitchers, because you talk about the fact that these pitchers and their catchers are oftentimes, you know, they have every statistic in the world available to them now about what this guy will swing at, what this guy will miss, what are the percentages are of everything he's done. And the catcher will go, yeah, but his good stuff is his fastball. Or the pitcher's like, right. I'm not letting him beat me with my third best pitch. I'm throwing him the fastball.
Right.
And
right.
instead right. of, yeah. you know, thinking about these things a little more, maybe, you know, with some of the knowledge that's provided to them about what's most likely to work here. We'll get into more of that. We're speaking with Terry McDermott, the author of Off Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception, after we check the news next on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Showcase studio on the Magnificent Mile. Terry McDermott, the author of Off Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception, is still on the phone with us. Did you hear that little commercial I did on the way in the news? The Sox and the Mariners are playing tonight.
Yes, they are. And in fact, the guy we were just talking about, James Shields, gave up the big dinger last night.
Oh,
so way to go, James.
Poor James. Is Felix Hernandez still pitching for the Mariners?
Well, what kind of a question is that, man?
He's
still pitching. Yeah.
He's on the Mariners. What do I care? I'm a Cubs fan. I don't know. They never play the Mariners. I don't follow the American League. I don't follow the junior circuit.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's check our records here the last century, see how the senior circuit is doing.
Here's what I know.
Yeah,
the Chicago Cubs won the World Series last year, and I will say that forever, and that's all I care about. Believe me, all my White Sox fans here in town still like to talk about how they won the World Series. I'm like, that was like a decade ago, remember? That's crazy. A decade ago. God, they hate that now. Is he still pitching? He is.
Yes, he is. Yes, he was hurt a little bit this year. He missed some time, but he's back. He's the king. The king is back on the hill.
I was looking at Baseball Reference earlier today. All right, so 2000. So he's four. Is he 4-3 so far? Is this updated? I think he's 4-3 so far this year. He hasn't had a really good year. I mean, he's had two really good years since the Cy Young year, though, right? In 2009, he went 19-5. Since then, 2014, he went 15-6. 2015, he went 18-9. So that's two pretty, really good years. But his overall career record's 158-112, which isn't bad, but it's not incredible. Is that mostly because the teams he plays on?
Yes, the team sucked. mostly, yeah. No, entirely. He's the king. Come on. Yeah, look, he's changed, he's, as everybody does. He came into the league at 19 and was just a pure, he threw heat. And he's developed a bunch of different pitches. He's one of those guys, there's a couple guys every generation, I think, who can pretty much throw whatever they want. I think Greinke's that kind of guy now. David Cullen was like that. You know, he can just almost make up pitches on the spot. And Felix is like that quite a bit. He's got enormous gifts as an athlete. His problem, and I guess every pitcher's problem, is he can make the ball do lots of things, but can he make it go where he wants it to go?
Yeah.
I mean, his pitches honestly break too much. So his biggest problem is putting them in the right place all the time. He's still there. He'll be there in the series this fall. You wait.
I'm sorry.
I can't believe I just said that.
Yeah, well, because you've clearly been drinking because it's the middle of the night.
He's there. He's still the ace. Well, actually, they have a really great young left-hander, James Paxton, who's really emerged as the ace of the staff now. But Felix is a good, solid, well above average big league pitcher, and will be for another several years, I think.
You write in the book that even if the hitter expects a fastball and gets one, the harder it is thrown, the less time he has to catch up to it. The faster it is thrown, the quicker it arrives. Guys who throw the hardest have the biggest advantage. The difference in time available to a hitter between a 90-mile-per-hour fastball and one thrown at 100 miles per hour is approximately 40 milliseconds. Doesn't sound like much, but it represents a 10% cut in the time allowed to the hitter, time a hitter can't afford to lose. So when Aroldis Chapman throws it that hard, and it's hard for guys to catch up to it, but he, although he loves throwing the fastball, also likes throwing, I believe, a slider. And the last, I believe he was the most recent, unless Glavin beat him afterwards, the most recent 300-game winner, was it Greg Maddux? Maybe one other person has done it since. But Greg Maddux, like you were talking about another pitcher earlier, I mean, what he topped out at generally most of his career, about 86 miles an hour for his fastball, right? So deception does play a huge part of true success. While the fastball and the harder you can throw it is great, especially for an inning at a time for Aroldis Chapman, for most guys, if they come out and try to throw six innings of fastball, especially when you're going to face a batter a second time, and that maybe that explains a little bit why, because you write about Felix Hernandez, and especially you kind of go over his perfect game throughout the book as you talk about the different pitches. But Felix, despite the fact that everybody knows he likes throwing fastballs early, and despite the fact that that isn't what always gets guys out, he tends to start his games, or at least he used to, throwing a ton of fastballs early on. Is part of that because the first time guys see somebody, it's harder to time it out, and then you got to work more stuff into it later in the game?
I think it's because humans are stupid. If I were a pitching coach, thank God for Major League pitchers that I'm not a pitching coach in the majors. I don't understand why pitchers don't throw more off-speed stuff early in counts. The truism of baseball is the best pitch in baseball is a located fastball. If you can throw a fastball where you want, you're going to succeed. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if you don't really have much of anything else. Just because you talked about how much time a hitter has. It takes 400ths of a second for the ball to go from the pitcher's hand to cross home plate. And the batter has to start to swing, decide where and if to swing halfway through that, 200ths of a second. That's how long it takes you to blink your eye. I mean, there is no time. So if you can throw hard, you're robbing time from the hitter. That's all pitcher's doing is robbing time. So if you can throw hard, for goodness sakes. But if you can't locate perfectly, and you talk Maddux, man, that guy was just a thief. Because he couldn't throw hard, and he would go a whole game without throwing a breaking ball. All he had was that little cutter. I mean, Mariano made the cutter famous because he was so great at it because he was in New York. But Maddox threw cutter after cutter after cutter, and he just threw it into a teacup and didn't have the break of Rivera's at all. It was, had this little 3 or 4 inch thing, but man, he just threw it where he wanted. And it's just, it, he was a, you know, he just cut you up, you know, a surgeon, and, you know, take out your heart and you stand there still watching him, wondering what happened. You know, guys, you can throw the ball where they want to throw it. I think maybe you can throw it any speed you want. If you can do that, you'd win.
But they can't all do that. So they develop the other pitches, right? And you write about it. You have a lot of great history of the game stuff that I didn't know, what, whether it comes to how the baseball is made and built and what goes into it, how many they use a game, different things like that. But especially the really early history of baseball, when it resembled cricket a little more than anything else, where the pitchers got a running start and then threw it underhanded, and the batters could actually even request where they wanted it. Now, what I didn't see you write about, maybe I missed it, is how willing were the pitchers to then throw it where the batter wanted? Did they say, sure, Mac, and then not throw it there? Or did they really not care at all? So, sure, fine, I'll serve it up to you. That's my job.
Well, I think pitchers started cheating the first time there were pitchers. I think that they started, nobody wants to do that, right? Nobody wants to.
I wouldn't think so.
Get the crap beat out of them. So, yeah, they started cheating almost immediately. You know, it was a hitter's game, but it didn't take many years, a couple, 10 or 15 years, 20 years, I guess, before they started letting them throw overhand. And as soon as that happened, then all hell broke loose. I mean, then they started doing everything they could possibly imagine. I mean, they were, we think about like the spitter being a terrible illegal pitch, they would, like, there was a guy who put the whole ball in his mouth and made it wet. Guys would take the ball and grind it into the dirt with their foot, with their spikes. You play the whole game with 3 or 4 balls.
And the balls weren't even good to begin with, right? I mean, they weren't put together like they were now.
Yeah, I mean, they were soft. I mean, they were certainly soft after a few innings. It was just horrible. I don't know how anybody ever hit them. You know, that's the whole dead ball era came because of that, because of the abuse these guys gave to the balls. I mean, now it's hard to imagine when a ball gets taken out of play every time it touches the dirt.
Yeah.
You know, then it's just, no, I'm sorry, this ball's here until it's gone. So it literally falls apart sometimes. It's a whole different baseball then. It's hard to imagine what it must have been like. nothing like what we see today,
yeah,
for
no
sure.
Kidding. So what is the best pitch, most successful pitch, outside of a well-located fastball?
Man, it's different in every era. You know, there, it depends on who the guy is. I mean, you know, Rivera's cutter, Carlton's slider, Koufax's curveball. But Willie Stargell said, you know, trying to hit Sandy Koufax's curveball is like trying to drink coffee with a fork. It just wasn't possible. So there's a guy, there are guys every era who just have pitches, single pitches that are impossible to hit. So I don't think there's ever been any one pitch that's unbeatable. I mean, as a Mariner fan, I mean, Randy Johnson's slider was right up there with Carlton's. I mean, Steve Carlton, the great St. Louis and Philly pitcher of the 70s, he was asked one time by Roy Firestone, he says, why were you put on this earth? And Carlton said, to teach the world how to throw a slider. You know, pitchers are weird dudes. You know, they're not, you know, players don't regard pitchers as players. I mean, it's really odd, because a lot of times the pitchers are the best athletes on the team.
Yeah.
Because they were the guy who was in high school. They were, you know, they lettered and everything.
Well, and pretty much funny, Buddy and I were just talking about this the other day, that every pitcher in baseball, it's funny to see when they bat and they really can't do much, so many of them, because, you know, in high school they were probably the best hitter. I mean, all these guys were probably by far the best player anywhere near anywhere back when they were in high school, and they probably all could kill the ball like crazy when they were hitting.
Yeah, right. That shows you how great professional athletes are, right?
Yeah.
At the thing that they do. Because you're right. I mean, every pitcher in the majors, or most of them, were the best hitter on their team when they were a kid, and now they can't hit anything.
Yeah,
it tells you how good the real hitters are. But the pitchers, if you think about it, I mean, I used to think that, you know, the best job in the world would be to be a punter on an NFL team.
Sure.
Right? Because what do you have to do, right? I mean, if you can punt, you can win four or five times a game. You know, and if the snap is wild, it ain't your fault. You know, you don't, you almost have no chance to screw up. You just go out there a few times. Nobody, they can't run into you. You just kick it, and it goes down the field. Then you trot off. You probably don't have to wash your uniform twice a year. but pitchers are pretty much like that. I mean, if you watch pitchers like before games, if you go out to the park really early and watch them, I mean, they're just hanging out. You know, they trot around. They might run a couple sprints. You know, they'll shag some balls. But they're just goofing.
I have always thought that to be a starting pitcher and have those 4 days where you're just hanging out at the park, eating some Cracker Jack, talking to the guys all day long, that would be pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. And they have a lot of time on their hands, so they always come up with new pitches.
Yeah.
That's where the pitchers come from, is all that downtime. They're just hanging out. That's got to be the coolest thing in the world. And plus, you know, they get paid quite a bit.
Yeah.
I heard.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And what do you make of, we touched on this a little bit earlier, but what do you make of all the statistics that are available today, the just amazing amount of information you could have about any batter, any hitter, yet a lot of these players tend to ignore it and go on gut instincts or what seems to be working and what seems to not be working?
Yeah, you know, there really is a lot of see the ball, hit the ball in the big leagues. A lot of people don't want to be confused. You know, they know what they can do. And they, especially with pitchers, the general feeling is that, you know, look, I don't care what this guy hits or doesn't hit. I know what I can do. And why should I let him dictate to me what's going to go on in the at-bat? It's foolhardy, I think. And I think over time that will change. I think people will be pitchers will be forced to take into account the data that's available to them. But right now, I think we're at sort of this early period in this where people don't, pitchers don't pay that much attention, don't want to. They don't want to cloud their minds. You know, professional athletes, baseball more than probably any other sport, there's so much randomness in it. You know, a hit a week is the difference between a guy who's 250 and a guy who's an all-star.
Yeah.
You know, and a hit a week is what? A ground ball in the hole. It can be anything. So it's like you try to do the same thing over and over again, over and over and over and over again, and yet the results are so disparate. They're just scattered all over the place. And you're going like, man, I did exactly the same thing as the last time. The guy took it into the third deck. It's just this bizarre outcomes. From guys who try to be as mechanical, as ruthlessly efficient as they can, and things happen. So they don't want to clutter their minds with other stuff. I mean, they just want to do the thing that they know how to do, the thing that they've been doing their whole life. I must drive, well, I know that for a fact that it drives coaches and teams crazy. And we've had a lot of, we're still in a period where there's a lot of friction, I think, between the people with the data and the players. There are a lot of players who adapted fully and love it, but they're regarded, even the player, who's a data freak is regarded weirdly by it's his teammates think he's an odd guy because they all know there's, you know, everybody's self-image is set when they're 15 or something like that. And as we were talking before, these guys were all studs when they were 15.
Yeah.
You know, so why should they have to like think, you know, they don't think for a living. It's like baseball. They have this one great skill. Love to do it.
Well, so when I watch Cubs games, I feel like Wilson Contreras, who catches for the Cubs mostly now, is always looking at the dugout between pitches. And I always assume that for a lot of these catchers, the manager or pitching coach or whoever is telling them what pitch to call. So I'm surprised that all these pitchers are getting away with just doing whatever I think this feels best. And that the managers aren't saying, okay, we have all the statistics that show we can't throw 80, 90% fastballs in the first inning, but here you are. so we're going to take this over and tell you what to throw. Why is that not taking more hold?
Well, it has. I mean, I think it's slowly ebbing away. I think it's going the other direction. I think that there's only a few guys in the managers in the majors that would call pitches. I wasn't aware of it. Madden does it all the time. I'm not a big Joe Madden fan, so I'm not surprised.
What? Oh, geez. Here we go. Man, you got a bitter thing going there, Ter. Bitter.
But Mike Socha calls all the pitches, too. I live in Southern California.
You also don't like Mike Socha, though. I read you wrote something like, and then God put Mike Socha in the Angels dugout.
But he calls all their pitches. You know, I was like, yeah, come on, guys. Let the pitchers pitch.
Oh, that is so funny. You write all this about how they have all this information, but they're either too proud or stupid to use it. And now you're going to be like, ah, just let the pitchers pitch. They know what they're doing.
I didn't say they knew what they were doing. That's not what I said.
That's true. You didn't. But you seem to intimate that if you're saying let them have control.
No, I'd be happy to have let them do that and let my guys just wail away. Look, Socha and Madden have both been very successful in their benighted lives.
Yes, so, they have.
Maybe they know what they're doing.
They have done well. So the book follows Felix Hernandez's perfect game and goes through the pitches, the fastball, the sinker, the knuckleball, the curveball, with little interesting bits of information on a lot of times how the pitch first started, who first used it, if that can be figured out, how it works, what it's supposed to do, and how it's been abused by pitchers since the game began. The book is called Off Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception by Terry McDermott. Terry, thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us. This was a pleasure.
Yeah, it was fun for me, too. Thanks for having read the book. It's nice.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good. I'm gonna keep reading it. I'm going to pass it along to my 16-year-old son. He's a pitcher, and he won't throw the ball any harder because he's afraid he's going to lose location. So he's the opposite of most pitchers out there right now, unfortunately. A little too much so. Thanks again so much, Terry. Thank you. We'll talk again soon, I hope so. Terry McDermott, Off Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception. You can get it online, or if you can find an actual bookstore, you can find it there.